Hello to all my fellow 101 History Podcast listeners. It is certainly good to be back on the air, and ironically knowing that today is St. Patrick's Day. Well, I will say this. Today has been a good St. Patrick's Day for me overall. For one, my wife and I spent the day out of town for most of the day today, and secondly, we were in historic Jamestown, probably about an hour, a little over an hour from where we live. And we attended, for the second straight year, Military Through the Ages, a program that has been running at Jamestown for now 40 years. Matter of fact, I didn't even realize it until just a short while ago, maybe a few weeks back or a month ago, that the program itself had been operating for now 40 years. I think it's wonderful that a program like this has been around for as long as it has. It has it draws a lot of crowds. It's a weekend event, so it's not just one day. It's Saturday and Sunday. You have reenactors whom are portraying ancient civilization periods from ancient Rome, ancient Greece. For example, you've got people whom are portraying themselves as Vikings. You have people portraying themselves from other periods of time, like the 30 Years' War or the 100 Years' War from over in Europe. And of course, my favorite periods of time are the American Revolutionary War period, as well as the War of 1812. However, I did also make sure to take the time to talk to those individuals whom were portraying Civil War, not just Civil War, common Civil War people in terms of officers whom were well known. They were also portraying as the what the average soldier would have been like or the average officer. I even got a chance to talk to a doctor. And you know, we do have to be reminded that that while anesthetics, for example, did exist during the time of the Civil War, being chloroform and ether, unfortunately, if you were severely wounded and you needed to have surgery right away, while yes, you did have anesthetics, you were not completely knocked out. In other words, you weren't put to sleep, so this way you wouldn't have to see what they were actually doing to you. As nice as that would have been to think that you could get knocked out, even with the convenience of anesthetics then, it just wasn't enough to knock you out to where the opposite happened. You were actually alive, witnessing a body limb being amputated just as a means of saving your life. I've often been reminded that the majority of soldiers during the Civil War period, for example, actually not only survived their amputations, but lived, in some instances, lived 20 years longer after having a limb amputated. It blows me away. I was also amazed that the doctor, the person portraying a Civil War doctor, he said it took about 10 to 12 minutes to perform an amputation. But then again, you would have to be on the move, even with your assistants, because you never know how many would have never known how many casualties would have been brought, how many severely wounded soldiers, that is, being brought into you. And the man told me and my wife that one question he was asked earlier in the day was, and it was came from a youngster, would you ever get nightmares knowing what you've seen and what you've had to perform? And the gentleman told us that, you know, it was probably very common for many Civil War doctors to have had nightmares over what they saw, knowing that regardless of what side the individuals were fighting on, knowing that if, you know, I was able to save some people's lives but couldn't save everyone's, and knowing what I was having to do just as a means of saving their life, it would give you chills. It would certainly make you not only appreciate your life, but knowing that life itself, you know, it's fragile. I mean, even history is fragile. I mean, I have to be reminded many of times that even the United States as a nation came close to losing it all. Most people don't realize that there was more than one assassination attempt on Abraham Lincoln's life. As a matter of fact, there were five total. John Wilkes Booth's assassination, which sadly prevailed, was the one that we get obviously get told about regularly. But what people don't realize is that had Abraham Lincoln been assassinated, say, 2 years before 1865, whoever would have taken his place probably would not have been able to have preserved the Union, let alone save it to where we would have had one section of the United States not unified while the other section is unified, but not in the same way as the opposing side. So, yes, as tragic as Abraham Lincoln's assassination was, without his leadership in a very trying period of time, we may not have a United States as we know it today. Well, what I do know, for those, before we begin this podcast segment episode, I will point out that for those of you who are interested in wanting to attend Military Through the Ages, I strongly recommend doing so. You will, it is definitely worth the while. It is definitely worth the time and getting the opportunity to talk to reenactors, whether it's from the Civil War, War of 1812, American Revolution, from ancient civilization times. It is even World War II. My father-in-law went with us, and he really enjoys World War II history, so we got a chance to interact with World War II interpreters there. So regardless of the period of time in which a war took place, it is certainly well worth the time in visiting at historic Jamestown. Well, I do know that we have a lot of ground to cover in part two of two to repercussions with regards to the Treaty of Ghent. And after this episode, we will then end this series with our epilogue. I tell you, treaty talks are a work of art unto themselves, and they do take time to get properly hammered out. And oftentimes it can be about momentum. And it just seems like right now the British have the upper hand. We have to wonder, will the Americans even get a break in terms of learning of good news? And once they get the good news, will that alter the current British approach to with regards to what they're demanding based upon their requests? So I think this is a good time now to shift gears and get back to where we need to be in part two of two with regarding repercussions of with the Treaty of Ghent in with the book we've been discussing, The Battle of Lake Champlain, A Brilliant and Extraordinary Victory by John H. Schroeder. So here we go with our first leadoff question. What demands did British officials propose per territorial requests? The British government was hoping to revise the Canadian border in reversing past errors from the 1783 Paris Treaty, which entailed requesting that the United States government give up all of the land in eastern Maine, including the British rights to obtaining access of all land along the southern slope to the St. Lawrence River, which connected Lake Ontario, as well as the United States surrender to Fort Niagara, including Sackett's Harbor, which is on Lake Ontario in northern New York, Michilimackinac, being well north of Detroit, given that the United States had control of territory in Michigan, but only in southeastern Michigan, in the area that we know as Detroit and present-day Ann Arbor, where the University of Michigan is. But Michilimackinac, which became later became Fort Mackinac, not around what we know as the line separating the northernmost mainland of Michigan with its upper peninsula. And then the islands of Passamaquoddy Bay that lie between present-day Maine and the Canadian province of New Brunswick. Well, I'll tell you, these are a lot of demands, not just for territory, but how the British want the Canadian border to be revised. And you have to remember, folks, Canada, you know, is part of the British Empire. So Britain, you know, they're going all out. I mean, yes, they are defending Canada, but the objective really for the British is to conquer the United States. And by conquering the United States, you know, not only the original 13 colonies resubmitting their allegiance, but all the other new states that have been admitted into the Union having to swear a new oath of allegiance. Kind of like how when Brigadier General William Hull surrendered Fort Detroit to Isaac Brock and Tecumseh early on in the conflict, the people of Detroit were forced to take up an oath of loyalty to the British. So, you know, we may be on our own territory, but it doesn't mean that our loyalties are still going to be with us. In other words, our loyalties could be taken from us without our own consent. The current military situation in North America by August and well into September is definitely in Britain's favor. There's no question about that. Late September 1814 brought official news to government leaders in London, which listed a barrage of British successes, from occupying eastern Maine to Nantucket Island's people surrendering unconditionally, to learning come September 27th that Major General Robert Ross and his forces routed the U.S. troops at Bladensburg, Maryland, which has often been referred to as the Bladensburg Races. Only for Major General Robert Ross's forces to proceed forward in the capture and burning of Washington, D.C. That truly was the lowest of lows for not just the people of the United States, but for the government. Officials in London, once they have received this news, and this truly to them is breaking news, it's the news that they've been wanting. It's the news that they can say to one another, well, the United States government has been burned. Everything is in such terrible disarray that maybe they just don't have it in them as an independent nation anymore. Maybe we should just, maybe they should just throw in the towel and decide that, hey, they simply can just no longer hack it as an independent nation and should return to us, given that they just really don't have what it takes no more. And maybe it could very well just be that they have an incompetent leader in James Madison. I know that doesn't sound nice to say, but in the eyes of the British, they don't view Madison as a competent commander-in-chief, and it is fair to say that there were many in America, most notably the Federalists, whom leading up to this war and even after the war begun, truly believed that James Madison was not a competent wartime leader. But I think a lot of that will eventually change following the aftermath of the burning of Washington. So yes, officials in London truly did believe that the capture and burning of Washington, D.C. would ultimately reduce the current state of American stubbornness at Ghent. Well, yes, some members to the U.S. delegation are very stubborn individuals, but just because they're stubborn, it doesn't mean that they could have a change of heart when it's least expected. Well, once the U.S. delegation read what had happened on their native soil, not only were they upset and angry by what the British had done, they actually became more persistent. They became more determined, more resolute as a team. They now had to reinvent things. They now had to, they had to perhaps alter some ways of thinking and realize that, well, you know, our people as a nation can do one of two things. They can completely surrender and let Britain take over to where there is no United States, or they can get back up and do something about it. How are they going to do something about it would probably be the bigger question, given that there has to now be a strong, urgent sense of revivalism. And of course, this is going to be taking place 3,000 miles across the ocean. But I would think it's fair to say that most notably, say, if you live in Baltimore and you've now learned about the burning of Washington, D.C., you're going to do whatever it takes to defend not only your city, but knowing that that Baltimore is America's fourth largest city, you're only about, 40 miles north of the Capitol. So it's not that far away, and now people in Baltimore are saying to themselves, well, if the British have burned Washington, D.C., there is no doubt in mind that we are next. And it's not a question of if it's going to happen, it's a matter of when, but it's also going to be a question of how well can we be prepared. We've got to be more than a step ahead. But if the British want to come to Baltimore and take and bring the fight to us, we're going to show them how well fortified our city's going to be. We're going to show them that we've got officers whom are not going to back down without a fight. We're going to show them that through the night, no matter what the obstacles are, that our people, not just only in Baltimore, but elsewhere, north or south of us, will be able to wake up and still see an American flag. They'll still be able to think to themselves and remind themselves that they live in the United States and that they will still be able to call their nation the United States. Yes, this is where patriotism is needed more than ever. Now, here's a term that I didn't know about until having read this book. The term is called the following. What is uti possidetis? U-T-I space P-O-S-S-I-D-E-T-I-S. What is uti possidetis? Possidetis. It's a doctrine aimed to ensure or enhance stability of newly independent colonies emerging as states. So it might be fair to say that this could have been something that would have been prevalent when Britain's 13 North American colonies from Maine, from as far north as New Hampshire and all the way as far south as Georgia, banded together to declare their official separation from England. And, you know, 13 newly independent colonies emerging as states. The big question is how are these one-time colonies becoming states? For example, how are they going to be ensured that their stability will be in play? But of course, that was back in the time of the Revolution. We've got to, you know, obviously focus on where we're at right now in the present day. But in early October, the British government proposed a peace plan to the United States by advising the Americans have no jurisdiction on the St. Lawrence River, no settlements on the Great Lakes, and no renewal of the 1783 and 1794 treaties, the 1783 Treaty of Paris that officially ended the Revolutionary War, and the 1794 Jay Treaty, which modified all outstanding issues between both nations that had not been resolved in the midst of the 1783 peace treaty talks. So, uti possidetis is basically a doctrine aimed to ensure or enhance the stability of newly independent colonies well-being, given that they are transitioning from colonies that were under the domain of another country, but now they are their own independent states under under a nation. Okay, yes, you have, of course, in 1812 there were 18 states. There still are 18 states in 1814, but you think about 18 states under their own nation. But now they're having to think about, you know, what's going to happen if an outside nation wants to conquer us. Posititas will no longer be in existence. What news event reached London come October 17th, 1814? The British fleet in the Chesapeake Bay initially attacked Baltimore, only to fall back and retreat, which included the word of Major General Robert Ross's death. Okay, so the British started to attack Baltimore. They started in their attack of Baltimore. They fell back. And ultimately, that was due in part, for one, there was inclement weather conditions. And, you know, we have to be reminded that even inclement weather conditions do have impacts for better and for worse. They can have a negative impact for one side, but a modified impact for the opposing side, to where the modifications prevail enough to where the opposing side may come away victorious, live to see another day of fighting. Well, the Americans won at Baltimore, and it's not so much that we won and that we live to see another day of fighting. But when Francis Scott Key, whom was aboard the British ship known as the HMS Tunnant, he was there on a diplomatic rescue mission to obtain the release of Dr. William Beanes, whom the British claimed had violated his parole or his neutrality oath. Apparently, Dr. Beanes, he was living in Upper Marlboro, Maryland, and confronted British soldiers whom were trespassing on his property without his consent. And when he confronted them, he had words for them, and the soldiers retreated. But in the middle of the night, the story has it that British officials came banging into his door and knocked it down and basically grabbed him out of his bed and literally jailed him. So they brought him and some others, other prisoners, aboard the HMS Tunnant, and this was done by the arrangement for Francis Scott Key to get on board the ship was through John Stuart Skinner, whom was the American envoy, whom had solid connections within the State Department, but also within the city of Baltimore. So as Francis Scott Key is aboard this ship, as it becomes nighttime, he's watching British ships firing at Fort McHenry, named after James McHenry, whom was a signer of the United States Constitution, and also served in George Washington's cabinet as a war secretary during Washington's second term. But Fort McHenry endured a wrath of British firings from their warships. One bomb that was fired almost blew up Fort McHenry, and thank heavens leadership recognized the severity of what lied at stake, to where they reconfigured the inside of the fort. They moved several barrels to different locations, and so basically, had they not done all that, the fort could have basically caved with the bomb and all that. So people being at the right place at the right time made all the difference. But ultimately, as night turned into morning, you know, Francis Scott Key is he's pacing himself left and right, not knowing what's going to happen come morning. Am I going to see an American flag flying over Fort McHenry? Or if we lose this thing, do I see a British flag flying over, knowing that a couple of weeks earlier we experienced the lowest of lows that we could have ever experienced as a nation? We've got to have a 360 here. We've got to have some kind of revival to ensure the American people that they are still living under a nation whose flag not only waves proud and tall, but is red, white, and blue with stars and stripes. Well, Francis Scott Key did see above the horizon through his spyglass that there was an American flag flying over Fort McHenry after the morning of September 12th of 1814. So gave proof through the night that our flag was still there. Trying times, especially considering this was our second war for independence. Well, the news about Baltimore, and yes, the word about Major General Robert Ross's death at Baltimore, yeah, that was a big blow right there. Whenever an officer of high-ranking status like his died in the battlefield, it really shook not only leadership, but it shook that of the soldiers below them, because once officers get shot and mowed down, where are these soldiers? Who are these soldiers going to be able to turn to? Well, the news about Baltimore also included information from northern New York State, but rather the news from up north featured reports of the U.S. naval fleet defeating and capturing a British Navy fleet on Lake Champlain, including George Prevost's sudden withdrawal from Plattsburgh. The newspapers in London saw the British defeat in New York State as events that were beyond disastrous. Goliath had been slewed by David. Usually it's the other way around, David slewed Goliath. But I thought it'd be kind of worth saying it differently. Goliath slewed by David. Yes, I can only imagine if I'm a British official in London learning of the news of what happened at Plattsburgh, not only getting defeated on the waters at Lake Champlain, but George Prevost suddenly withdrawing from Plattsburgh. I'm thinking to myself, what is it with this guy? Was he drunk? Was he just simply not thinking? Was he naive? What is going on with this guy? Yeah, I think I wouldn't be the only one myself. Did British government officials get forced into making revisions for the three-man team following the battle outcomes at Plattsburgh, Lake Champlain, and Baltimore? Yes, Lord Bathurst reshifted his focus on revising the Canada-U.S. border. Hang tight here for just a moment, folks. October 18th. Saw Lord Bathurst emphasize per his personal orders that utai possidetis, as you possess, was to be the main focal point for the peace settlement. Britain was requesting eastern Maine, Mackinac Island, or in Michigan, Fort Niagara, including that the United States returned Forts Erie and Malden, both in Canada. Britain, on the other hand, was willing to offer up a return of forts in Castin and Machias, Maine. Nothing was mentioned about Sackett's Harbor, Lake Champlain, and territory along the St. Lawrence River. The ramifications, including the severity of the British defeat at this particular moment in time, was not fully understood nor valued. Or valued, I should say, per what had happened in Baltimore and Plattsburgh at the time the new proposal was introduced. But once news got to Ghent of British defeats at Baltimore and Plattsburgh, the British delegation, when they received this, I think it'd be fair to say their jaws dropped. I know mine would if I was a part of that delegation. The British delegation is dejected. They had never really seen this happen, most notably since they have been convening at Ghent. I mean, yes, those individuals would have learned about what happened at Lake Erie and at Fort Meigs and Fort Stevenson in present-day Fremont, Ohio, as well as Americans prevailing at Fort Wayne and other areas of Indiana, or what was the Indiana Territory, and then recapturing present-day southeastern Michigan. Those things were one thing, but for what took place just a couple of weeks after the burning of Washington, this really was a drastic change of events. I think it's fair to say that British government officials really thought that after the burning of Washington had happened, that nothing else was going to happen to where the United States could reclaim some kind of miraculous momentum that would be able to greatly modify what had happened come late August. So once news got to Ghent of the British defeats at Baltimore and Plattsburgh, yes, the British delegation is dejected versus the American delegation being elated. The Americans now, folks, have something good to celebrate. It didn't alter peace talks altogether, but the delegation not only has something good to celebrate about privately, they can also come up with some new proposals in terms of coming away with what they want when the final treaty is hammered out. Yes, this war hasn't ended yet, but people whom have heard about the news, including the U.S. government, now feel more confident more than ever that, you know, even though this war is going to probably go on for another year, but we have some momentum on our side that we just didn't have. And it's momentum that is much needed, given that confidence in this war had probably reached an all-time low. Yes, we had some luck the year before with Fort Meigs and defeating Tecumseh at the Battle of the Thames in southwest Ontario, reclaiming Detroit, defeating Robert Harriet Barclay's naval fleet at Lake Erie. All those things were good, but that happened the year before. So one would say, well, that doesn't mean anything now, especially knowing what is taking place in 1814, late 1814, that is. Besides having a joyous celebration in the midst of learning about Britain's defeats at Baltimore, Lake Champlain, and Plattsburgh, how did the U.S. delegates respond afterwards? Well, of course, we all would think that they are joyous, but I think it's important to realize that even in the midst of learning about this exciting news, we have to ask ourselves, okay, how are the delegates going to go forward? How are they going to view things going forward? Well, for one, John Quincy Adams viewed the British fallout from up north as something so large that it would give the press, aka news reporters, a field day in writing up scathing reports about George Prevost's leadership from within, being that of his leadership in Canada as well as England. Not just news reporters from the United States writing up these scathing reports, but really more so in Canada and eventually in England. Henry Clay saw diplomatic talks going forward to have better chances or means in attaining peace. However, these recent victories at Baltimore and at Champlain, in Henry Clay's eyes, would probably get overlooked. Henry Clay, though, firmly believed that peace itself could be more doable if British forces were to be defeated down south. In other words, folks, what are the British trying to eye? What are they trying to eye themselves for obtaining possession-wise down south? The Gulf, not the Gulf of Mexico, but the Gulf along the Atlantic Ocean that entails present-day New Orleans, Louisiana, Mobile, Alabama, and the British do have they have a lot of interests in that area, the Gulf with the Mississippi River. So that is something that the Americans know that they need to be able to keep in their possession and not let the British take it, because if they do, then they would obviously cut off commerce. In other words, goods moving from north to south, going all the way into present-day New Orleans. So that is another matter of national security that Henry Clay is worried about. William Crawford, whom was the U.S. minister to France, he was the first person to emphasize the importance behind victories in northern New York. He compared the naval victory at Lake Champlain as the equivalent to what happened a year earlier in September of 1813 when an entire British fleet surrendered to U.S. naval forces under Commodore Oliver Hazard Perry. Crawford wrote to Henry Clay about the triumph in New York State. James Bayard saw the victory or victories at Baltimore in northern New York as measures of revivalism. Given August of 1814, I know I mentioned this earlier, but I can reference it again here. Given that August of 1814 represented an all-time low in American self-esteem, knowing British forces burned Washington, D.C., the debacle at Bladensburg, Maryland, and Washington, D.C., as terrifying and as sad as it was knowing that it did happen, all of a sudden, in just a matter of a few weeks' span, we've gone from the lowest of lows now to unprecedented highs with these victories at Baltimore and in northern New York at Champlain and Plattsburgh. The American people's spirits are lifted. They are lifted knowing that, hey, there is a better likelihood that our nation will still remain intact as one. These victories may not have sealed the war itself, but it has given us something to feel good about, given that we hadn't seen anything in about a year's time to really feel good about. Now we know that perhaps it may take a little bit longer, but who knows? Maybe sometime after 1815 begins that we could see a treaty in place. I mean, little do most people know at this point in time. Nobody knows. The average person does not know that there is already a treaty discussion or treaty talks taking place overseas. All they know is that a war is going on. They've heard the highs. They've heard many of lows. They've learned of utter devastation with their capital, but now they have to wonder how much longer can this fight go on, knowing whether or not the United States as a nation can survive, because as we learned from a previous episode a while back, the United States government is about to run out of money. It's one thing to fund something, but you can't fund something forever, especially knowing if, for one, the war is not going to your favor, and two, you know, if you run out of money, how else are you going to obtain more money? And of course, we did learn that from another episode back that both parties did agree to put aside personal differences and work together for the common good of the nation by agreeing to new taxes that would raise revenue. So knowing that there was a good likelihood the war would go into the start of 1815. Come November 1814, had political support for the war in North America begun to show signs of declining in England? So think about it, folks. If you live in England and you're an everyday average person, and you've learned of the news, you learned of the highest of highs, and that the British burned Washington. And all of a sudden, now you've learned the lowest of the lows, that the British were defeated at Baltimore and at northern New York. If you're an average person in England, you have to wonder, when should we end this war? What can we do to end it so that no more lives have to be lost, or that no more further confrontations have to be taken up? Well, for starters, Britain's state of finances are in not so good shape. Okay, if your government's state of finances are in not so good shape, that also means that the government is under greater pressure to obtain peace measures. Secondly, people made it clear, especially those people whom worked in the commercial and shipping sector industries, they voiced concerns about rises in costs and insurance rates. That's right, folks, insurance rates. Insurance is not something that is for that has existed only in modern day times. We do have to be reminded, even in colonial times, there were people of different trades who needed to have their goods be insured for X amount of money. And so, yes, rise in costs to build more ships, costs to provide soldiers with essential equipment. Nothing's free, but think about it. If the rise in costs and insurance rates are going up, then the harder it becomes to not only obtain supplies, but to ensure that that the rates that the Army needs based upon what the commercial and shipping sectors are able to work up and provide for. There's no guarantee that those rates would be locked in and secured, say, after 1815. I mean, I don't think both nations want this war to last well. Not only do they not want the war to last throughout the majority of 1815, but they simply want something to be resolved over time to where further bloodshed can be halted altogether. Third, many in England, including members of Parliament, were skeptical about a new round of taxes, given that the war itself would carry over into 1815. It's fair to say that many individuals, given that they are now having a change of heart about the direction in which this war is going, why should we vote for another round of taxes if the outcome is not going to be to our favor? Shouldn't the taxes be used for something else? Yeah, that's always a common statement or a common remark, regardless of what's at stake. November 18th of 1814, a top-secret British letter or a note dated from August the 19th. It was this top-secret British letter that was dated from August 19th to the U.S. delegation officially became public in London. 3 months later, folks, the Madison administration released the letter to Congress on October 10th. Remember, folks, it's taken about at least 5 weeks at best for mail to get from the United States to Europe and vice versa. So this letter that was officially dated from August 19th, that means, folks, it took about 7 weeks and 3 days, just a couple of weeks over the 5 week, average. So once the letter is released to Congress on October 10th, it will eventually make its way into American newspapers. Once it does get into American newspapers, British officials are not so thrilled. Many of them are disgusted by the U.S. government's conduct behind releasing sensitive information out to the greater public. Well, this happens even in today's time, folks, where sensitive information, somebody gets told not to do it, but yet they end up doing it, and they usually have a compelling reason for doing it, for better or for worse. But yes, sensitive information does get released out. And the sensitive information that got released out to the greater public pertained to this letter and the dispatches or the notes within the letter that contained all of Britain's demands ranging from creation of an Indian buffer state to requesting the Americans surrender of their existing presence along the five Great Lakes. Britain's requests per dispatches revealed led U.S. government officials to believe that the war itself was one of conquest. Yeah, if I was a U.S. government official after reading all this, I would say to myself that, yes, it's very obvious that the British objective was to conquer America to where America as a nation would simply no longer exist. Around mid-November, what sensitive issue did the American did American delegates agree to keep per their initial request? The U.S. delegation agreed to have preserved their fishing rights along the Canadian waters, given this particular privilege had been provided per agreement talks from the 1783, being the Treaty of Paris that ended the Revolutionary War. So, yes, this is very vital, simply in part because in the eyes of John Quincy Adams, he ardently supported the fishing right, given how important it served to Massachusetts's maritime economy. If the United States' fishing rights, most notably in New England, were taken away from them, given that their rights to fish existed along Canadian waters, if those rights were taken away, then not only does the Massachusetts maritime economy suffer, but the people whom work within that economic sector, their livelihoods are ruined. You know, it was bad enough that as much as I enjoy learning about Thomas Jefferson, I have to be reminded that yes, while as smart as his ideas were in wanting the American people to become more economically self-sufficient and not rely on trading with Britain in terms of exportation of goods going 3,000 miles across the ocean to receive goods from them, given that they were impressing our sailors along the high seas, by halting the trade with Britain, Jefferson believed that it would eliminate impressment altogether, and you know Britain would come to her senses and realize that they need to abandon the practice of impressment altogether. But the bottom line is that it was bad enough in 1807 that New Englanders felt the wrath of the Embargo Act, and up to 10,000 New Englanders were put out of work. That was bad enough. I can't imagine New Englanders losing their rights to fish along Canadian waters. And we're not just talking recreational, folks. This is the kind of fishing that's, you know, like commercial fishing that for cod. Once they bring in their catch, they will salt the cod down to where it's well preserved and transport the cod, most notably to the Caribbean, for people within the Caribbean region to eat. I mean, yes, people in New England will eat cod, but cod is a staple, not just in the United States, but elsewhere throughout the world. So we do have to be reminded that global economies did exist, that it's not just a 21st century thing. Global economies have been existing probably since the earliest of times, we could go back to ancient civilization times to learn about global economies if we had to. But as for the United States being adamant support of having their fishing rights along Canadian waters be upheld, they did agree to remain silent on the matters pertaining to the Mississippi River. Come November 26th, what had the British delegation done differently from a strategical point? Britain's three-man team removed requests previously demanded from redrawing the Canadian border to requesting the U.S. cede or turn over territory and establishing an Indian buffer state. Recent U.S. victories from Baltimore, Maryland to northern New York State and Plattsburgh, Lake Champlain had proven vital in the sudden shift where Britain's delegation is now on the defensive by not having much to show for as previously before, but only by weeks. It's amazing, folks, how, you know, one party can have all sorts of demands without any boundaries. And now, within a few weeks later, their demands have had to change because the outcome is now not in their favor. In the midst of everything that had transpired along the battlefront per each side's victories, defeats, to casualties, did both nations ultimately favor peace? They did. And it's a good thing, too. It's good to see that even in the midst of some severe hostilities, knowing that, you know, we have to be reminded that even in 1813, the United States was not immune. We won a battle in Canada. It was part of the Niagara campaign. And I do need to read more about it. I know bits and pieces about the burning of York. There is a book out there called Capital in Flames, The Burning of York, which is present-day Toronto, Ontario. Toronto being the capital of Ontario. And, of course, Canada's national capital is Ottawa. But in 1813, after defeating British forces in Canada, high-ranking leaders of the American army lost control of their soldiers, to where their soldiers went into York and looted people's homes and set their homes on fire, left over 100 families homeless. And the officers on the British side whom were leading the battle, not only had they lost the battle, but they were court-martialed. So it was bad enough that they were court-martialed, and in the eyes of the British, maybe that needed to happen. But it was bad enough that for the Americans, they let their soldiers get out of hand, to where there were no boundaries set after the victory, to where they destroyed government buildings, looted people's homes, private property was destroyed. So because of the burning of York, that is what led British officials to say, well, if they can come into our territory and burn our properties and our government buildings without the people's consent, then we will wage a war on them on their own territory, and we will see to it that they feel the wrath of destruction, the wrath of, of course, little did we know that it would be on our own, within our nation's capital soil. But as British officials said, you know, it's one thing for them to declare war on us, but if they can't defend their own home soil, being that of the capital, the wilderness, then how can they expect to protect the well-being of their people? So this is where both sides have engaged in some very nasty hostilities towards one another when it comes to destroying private property and government buildings. So, yes, we all have been told that the British did burn Washington, and while they did, we do have to be reminded that the United States was guilty of burning British government buildings in Canada the year before. So this is obviously a time where eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth prevailed. And now all of a sudden, both sides ultimately have come, are experiencing coming to Jesus moments where they want peace. The bigger question is how are they going to attain it? And that's what we've obviously been talking about this entire time per these last two episodes, most notably with repercussions here. But as to answer the question, in the midst of everything that had transpired along the battlefront per each side's victories, defeats, to casualties, and knowing that both nations ultimately now are favoring peace, how is it that both sides can agree to peace now more than ever? Well, for one, trade in the form of exportation had crippled each nation's economy. And secondly, in the midst of Napoleon Bonaparte's fall, back from April of 1814, this now means that France herself is no longer an enemy of Britain's, which halted further needs behind engaging in impressment, meaning that Britain now is coming to the realization that maybe we no longer need to be impressing American sailors along the high seas. Both sides were even willing to go as far as exchanging prisoners, along with Britain agreeing to return those slaves they had freed from their masters during the height of the Chesapeake campaign. And folks, this is important to know, because during the height of the Chesapeake campaign, Britain, British forces, they would, their men would come off the ships and they would terrorize people's homes along the Chesapeake Bay, including Virginia's Northern Neck. Maryland's Chesapeake Bay wasn't spared. The British even conducted their center command base was at Tangier Island, an island that that dates back many of centuries. Matter of fact, Captain John Smith, whom was a part of the first initial group of men who came over to settle Jamestown, explored Tangier Island. But the British did establish their center command base at Tangier Island, and that is where they planned their mastermind attack of America's capital, being Washington, D.C. And yes, when they launched their raids along coastal villages along the Northern Neck of Virginia, including the various inlets and towns along the Chesapeake Bay, they basically were urging the slaves to rebel against their masters, and many slaves provided British officials with all the most essential intelligence about where people stored things. You know, they left things out in plain sight. So that's how British forces went about imposing their will on Americans living along the coast. Many people's homes were burnt. Sadly, many families were displaced. Many families lost family members due to violence. People were taken against their own will. So this was all part of payback per what had happened the year before up in York, Ontario. Britain's naval defeat at Lake Champlain and Governor-in-Chief Sir George Prevost's disgraceful retreat from Plattsburgh helped pave the way for the Ghent Peace Treaty, as Britain was forced to modify peace requests, including coming to grips with her current fiscal state and increasing opposition domestically towards the war. Yes, domestically, folks, by our own people towards this war. Well, we've covered everything for this episode of part two of two for repercussions with the peace talks at Ghent. When I'm on the air again next, we will be discussing the epilogue, and we will also hammer out some final stuff in regards to the Treaty of Ghent, and we will learn when the official Treaty of Ghent was signed in late 1814, and we will also learn how in the aftermath of when the Treaty of Ghent was signed, how things would play out come the start of 1815. Well, thank you for your time as always, and wherever you all may live, continue to stay safe and continue to do everything you can to learn about history. Whether you live in the United States or elsewhere, just continue to learn this stuff because it is vital. Not only do you have the power to share it with others, but you also have the power to be able to see to it that people from younger generations can be inspired by this. And even if it's something that may be sensitive, still inspire them to learn about it so that they can see for themselves, okay, how can my generation go about learning this so that we can see to it that the same mistakes don't get made again. That's what we have to do. And one of the things I really liked about today's event at Jamestown was that people from different backgrounds, people of different races were present talking with the greater public about their role, the roles that they would have been serving in during the times in which the events took place. But we have to see more of this in order to help assure that everybody's story does get told and that everybody benefits. That's, to me, that's a win-win situation. Well, thank you for your time, as always, and I look forward to being back on the air to the epilogue of the Battle of Lake Champlain, a brilliant and extraordinary victory. Take care and stay safe.